This is the first day of this February 2010 two-day Sesshin. And I'll be reading from several texts. One of them is A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle. Many of you may be familiar with this book. It's very popular, but it has some incredibly important material in it. The second part, I'll be reading from some reflections that myself about pain, and in the third part today, we'll be working with Katsuki Sakita's book Zen Training. This is kind of an old book. It was published in 1975. At that time, Zen Master Sakita was 83 years old, having spent 60 years of his life doing Zazen. So I want to start by saying that this is a heavy topic I've chosen. It's pain and suffering, or suffering and pain. But I think there's an enormous value in looking directly at this, especially for beginners, because we know that appearances to the contrary, perhaps, everyone comes here because of suffering or pain or both. I want to start with Eckhart Tolle in a little section he calls conscious suffering. If you have young children, give them help, guidance, and protection to the best of your ability. But even more important, give them space. Space to be. They come into this world through you, but are not yours. The belief, "I know what's best for you," may be true when they are very young, but the older they get, the less true it becomes. The more expectations you have of how their life should unfold, the more you are in your mind instead of being present for them. Eventually, they will make mistakes and will experience some form of suffering, as all humans do. In fact, they may make mistakes only from your perspective. What to you is a mistake may be exactly what your children need to do or experience. Give them as much help and guidance as you can, but realize that you may also at times have to allow them to make mistakes, especially as they begin to reach adulthood. At times, you may also have to allow them to suffer. Suffering may come out to them, may come out of the blue, or it may come out as a consequence of their own mistakes. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could spare them from all suffering? No, it wouldn't. They would not evolve as human beings and would remain shallow, identified with the external form of things. Suffering drives you deeper. The paradox is that suffering is caused by identifications with form and erodes identifications with form. A lot of it is caused by the ego, although eventually suffering destroys the ego, but not until you suffer consciously. Humanity is destined to go beyond suffering, but not in the way that the ego thinks. Now I'm going to stop right there and move on to something else. We'll return to that later. I'm thinking that we can start with consideration of extreme pain and maybe garner some insight that will apply at least to some extent to any pain, mental or physical. If we examine the extremes, we often can have a more clear insight about the middle way. There's a story, very famous story. This won't be the first time you've heard it. This may not be the first time you heard it, and there are many times that this story is given in Buddhism. A woman named Kisa Gotami was the wife of a wealthy man of Savatthi. This is, of course, in the Buddha's time. Her story is one of the most famous ones in Buddhism. After losing her only child, Kisa Gotami became desperate and asked if anyone can help her. Her sorrow was so great that many thought she had already lost her mind. Someone told her to meet Buddha. Buddha told her that before he could bring the child back to life, she should find white mustard seeds from a family where no one had died. She desperately went from house to house, but to her disappointment, she could not find a house that had not suffered the death of a family member. Finally, the realization struck her that there is no house free from mortality. She returned to the Buddha, who comforted her and preached to her the truth, which we will get to. She was awakened and entered the first stage of arhatship. Eventually, she became an arhat, that is, a deeply enlightened person. One thing to notice about this story is that the Buddha doesn't explain to Kisa how to deal with her loss. He comes up with a way that will enable her to realize for herself how to deal with it. Ideally, all of Zen is this way. Guidance is given mainly to enable you to discover for yourself the way. Nothing else actually works. This losing a child is probably the most painful thing in life. I haven't lost my children, but my father and mother did. My third brother died at the age of 15 from melanoma, and a very rare thing for somebody 15 years old. It was completely unexpected. It just blew us away in 2 weeks. We knew he had been sick, but suddenly it became clear that he would die very shortly. My mother seemed to deal with it fairly well. But my dad just went into a despair which lasted 20 years. Another friend I had that died, I was in college. He had been a close high school friend and led me down the evil paths of smoking, some drinking, driving fast. And this man, at the age of 21, because of a defect in his 48 Chevy, went off the road and hit a telephone pole. And his name was Skip Biggers, just to make this feel like it's real. Skip was a real enchanting guy, a lot of charisma. His mother, within 2 or 3 weeks after his death, had gotten rid of all of his clothes, every picture, every vestige of him having been part of the family. She was just unable or unwilling to deal with the pain and wanted desperately for it to disappear. My dad, he took the route of this despair, and I want to say about these that these are two very neurotic reactions that make it impossible for us to move on, to let go of the past, to let the pain naturally subside in time and ultimately disappear. If one devises a way to not remember a loved one because of the pain, one simply never heals. On the other side, if one carries around despair for years and years, it must mean that one has not actually been able to accept the pain of deep grieving, which ultimately releases us. Grieving is essential, just as it's essential to be able to forgive one who has hurt you. Not in the least for your own mental and spiritual well-being. I found myself extremely interested in a couple of stories that I've seen in the last couple of years. The stories involve some people who had been very deeply wronged. One was a man who was in prison for more than 20 years for a crime he didn't commit. He was framed by someone who was unable to speak the truth at the time. almost unbelievably, really, a few of these people have come to the point where they harbor no animosity toward what has happened to them. None whatsoever. It's almost unbelievable, but it's true. And someone also mentioned to me that Nelson Mandela went through this process of letting go of the hatred he felt for those who had wronged him in the years he was imprisoned. And then we know that when apartheid was defeated in South Africa, he came up with this idea of the forgiveness commissions, which worked quite well for people. That South African story is one of the noblest in recent history anywhere. How can some people do this? The answer has to be that they must do this. They feel pain and allow themselves to feel the pain, which is just what my friend's mother did not do. They allow themselves to feel the pain so intensely, and that to truly let go of it is the only way not to destroy oneself, not to bury oneself alive, in effect, with holding on to hatred. I'd like to just quote something in regard from Robert Aiken's book, Encouraging Words. He quotes another man, Kobin Chino Roshi, I don't know who this is, who was asked by a student, "What does gate gate parasam gate bodhi svaha mean?" And he answers in this way. It doesn't mean anything, actually. Everything is falling apart. Fall apart. Fall apart. All together fall apart. We can't do anything about it. This is what gate gate really means. There's nothing to hang on to. So between the two extremes I mentioned about, there's a middle way or a normal way to deal with pain. And I'm using the normal in the sense of not of the average way that people deal with pain, but in a spiritually profound way. This normal is also ultimately natural, and it is the true gateway to the end of suffering. This is what Zen Master Ganto did when a robber ran him through with a sword. He gave this great shout, and much, much louder than that, and with his whole being. And centuries later, when the young Hakuin in Japan in around the time of our revolution, middle 1700s. Hakuin heard this story as a young man in Buddhism, as a young monk, and completely misunderstanding it, was ready to reject Buddhism. He had apparently thought, his idea was, his concept was that the Zen master either must die silently or in a very macho way, let himself be run through. But that wasn't the case. Ganto shouted. Though we can talk about this, but intellectual understanding of this immediate, direct, undefended experience is only of almost no value. It only has value if it leads to experiential understanding. When we ourselves get to the point where we can deal with pain in this natural way. So now we've looked at the most authentic way of dealing with extreme pain. Since most of us, hopefully, are not dealing with this sort of thing in Sesshin, the real question before us is, what is normal and natural with regard to more ordinary pain, like the pain of zazen, especially late in the round or in the afternoon of the second day? Surely the first step is to feel it fully. not to just take refuge in by separating oneself. And those words mean going off into a vortex of thoughts about the pain and how the pain might be avoided. This is a way of resisting reality. I had one neighbor friend of mine, a number of years ago, he told me that when he was running marathons, which he did quite often, he would have to go into deep thoughts and daydreams in order not to feel the pain. This actually probably works to some extent. But unfortunately, this will not aid us in recovering our true nature, uncovering our true nature. It doesn't help with suffering and going beyond suffering. Being normal with regard to pain would also not mean not responding through it through some self-image. And this is what I think Hakuin thought, that he had this image of how a Zen master should respond to being run through with a sword. You have the tough guy image, or now too the tough woman image. And then you also have people who will say in words, I'm the wimpy type who really can't stand pain. I just can't stand it. When either of these two things, the tough guy or woman or the wimpy type, either of these two ways is inappropriate. And it can get one into big trouble. If you don't listen to the pain in your body, illness can become very serious before you deal with it. And in Zazen, if you get your position wrong, you could hurt yourself. There are plenty of people over the years who have hurt themselves because they pushed it too hard. They torqued their hip too hard or whatever. So you need to listen to the pain. What we need to do is find the way to sit that will be, or sit many different positions that will be comfortable enough to make good Zazen possible and not get us into long-term trouble by overstressing our joints or whatever. So pain is, after all, actually any kind of pain, an important guide in life, often pointing to something that must be carefully evaluated. On the other side of listening to the pain, we need to not let ourselves go crazy to trying to find a way to avoid all pain, because some pain is a part of this practice, a necessary part of the practice, in fact. And that's because it gives us strong impetus to take refuge in concentration. Often in our Zendo here, concentration is called involvement with the practice. And it's this complete absorption in the practice that can take the sting out of pain, very least, and sometimes make it possible to transcend the pain altogether. Also, it's pain, from my own experience, that makes the first exertions possible. Exertions are when you just make an extreme effort. You're in enough pain that you make an extreme effort to concentrate. Sometimes in sesshin, a person will lose oneness with sesshin. They'll start to resist sesshin, going off in thoughts. And all kinds of pains will come upon one. One just hates being here. And then you turn around and say, well, I'm gonna go the other way, directly into concentration. This is an exertion. And this is what makes you one with the sesshin again. And the feeling is quite wonderful when you're one with sesshin, and rather hellish when you're not one with sesshin. So now I want to read some words by Katsuki Sakita, excuse me. This guy was a very, very accomplished Zen person. especially by the time he was by the time he wrote this book. In fact, it almost looks to me like he's kind of forgotten how it is for beginners, but still, I think this has value. In studying Zen, we start with practice. Now, it's true that Zen is concerned with the problem of the nature of mind, so it necessarily includes an element of philosophical speculation. However, while the philosopher relies mainly on speculation and reasoning, in Zen we are never separated from our personal practice, which we carry out with our body and our mind. Edmund Husserl, this was 35 years ago or so, the founder of phenomenology, may seem to come close to Zen in his ideas when he advocates a technique called phenomenological reduction and says that he ignores the ego as a person arranged on objective time and arrives at pure phenomenon. However, like other philosophers, he does not seem to go beyond a purely mental exercise. In Zen training, we also seek to extinguish the self-centered individual ego, but we do not try to do this merely by thinking about it. It is with our own body and mind that we actually experience what we call pure existence. The basic kind of Zen practice is called Zazen, and in Zazen we attain samadhi. He skipped a few years here. In this state, the activity of consciousness is stopped, and we cease to be aware of time, space, and causation. The mode of existence which thus makes its appearance may at first sight seem to be nothing more than mere being or existence. However, if you really attain this state, you will find it to be a remarkable thing. At the extremity of having denied all and having nothing left to deny, we reach a state in which absolute silence and stillness reign, bathed in a pure, serene light. Buddhists of former times called this state annihilation or nirvana. But it is not a vacuum or mere nothingness. It is utterly different, too, from the unconscious state of the patient under anesthesia upon the operating table. There is a definite wakefulness in it. It is a condition of existence that recalls the impressive silence and stillness that we experience in the heart of the mountains. In ordinary daily life, our consciousness works ceaselessly to protect and maintain our interests. It has acquired the habit of utilitarian thinking, looking upon things in the world as so many tools, in Heidegger's phrase, and treats them in the context of equipment. It looks at objects in the light of how they can be made use of. We call this attitude the habitual way of consciousness. This way of looking at things is the origin of man's distorted view in the of the world, and he comes to look upon himself too, herself too, in the context of equipment, and fails to see his own true nature. This way of treating oneself and the world leads to a mechanical way of thinking, which is the cause of so much suffering of modern man, and which can, under some conditions, lead to the development of mental illness. Zen aims at overthrowing this distorted view of the world, and Zazen is the means of doing it. On coming out of samadhi, it can happen that one becomes aware of one's being in its pure form. That is, one experiences pure existence. This experience of pure existence of one's being, associated with the recovery of pure consciousness in samadhi, leads us to the recognition of pure existence in the external world, too. Discussion of these topics inevitably leads into epistemological tangles, but let us proceed for a moment, granting that such recognition of pure existence is possible. To look at oneself and the objects of the external world in the context of pure existence is kensho, or realization. After this has been achieved, since Buddha himself did so, and this has been achieved since Buddha himself did so, by men and women of every generation who bear witness to its feasibility. This experience, as we have stressed, is attained by the training of body and mind. Reason comes later and illuminates the experience, and thus the two wheels of the cart of cognition are completed. If one goes climbing in the Alps, one is probably led to do so in the first instance by the beauty of the mountains. When one starts to climb, however, one finds it's a matter of working one's way along patiently, step by step, progressing with great care and caution. Some knowledge of climbing technique will be essential. It's the same with Zen. We take it up in search of the meaning of life or in hope of solving the problem of our existence. But once we actually start, we find we have to look down at our feet, and we are faced with practice followed by more practice, training followed by more training. It must be done patiently and seriously. Much of this book is concerned with the technique of Zazen. I would add, as Roshi often does, that Zazen is not a matter of technique, ultimately. Ultimately, it's a matter of heart. But there's no question that certain things, in breathing and posture and that, help greatly. And that's what Sakita is talking about, technique here. Our aim in practicing Zazen is to enter the state of samadhi, in which, as we have said, the normal activity of consciousness is stopped. This is not something that comes easily to us. I think that's the biggest understatement in the book here. This is not something that comes easily to us. The beginner in Zen will usually be told to start by practicing counting his or her breaths. That is, to count each exhalation up to 10 and then start again. How can we prevent our thoughts from wandering? How can we learn to focus our attention on one thing? I'm skipping around here a bit. The answer is that we cannot do it with our brain alone. The brain cannot control its thoughts by itself. The power to control the activity of our mind comes from the body, and it depends critically, as we'll show in later chapters, he says, on posture and breathing. With regard to posture, we need only say at this stage that stillness of the body engenders stillness of the mind. Immobility is a first essential. Traditionally, and for good reasons, we sit down to practice because, among other reasons, it is in this position that we can keep our bodies still, but our minds wakeful. Immobility results in a diminution of the stimuli reaching the brain until eventually there are almost none. This will give rise in due course to a condition in which you cease to be aware of the position of your body. It's not a state of numbness, for you can move your limbs and body if you want, but if you keep your body still, it is not felt. This condition I call off-sensation. In this state, the activity of the cortex of the brain becomes steadily less and less, and we can regard this condition as a preliminary to entering samadhi. We continue to breathe, of course, as we sit, and it will be shown later that our ability to concentrate our attention, to remain wakeful, and ultimately to enter samadhi depends on our method of breathing. Even those who have not practiced Zazen know that it is possible to control the mind by manipulating the breathing. I think this is probably true in Japan. I'm not so sure that it'd be true here. Anyway, quiet breathing brings about a state of mind. If when you feel like shouting with rage, you keep your breath bated and you make yourself quiet, you will find that you can control your anger. Particular forms of breathing automatically appear in connection with various forms of activity, as we shall describe later. In Zazen, we breathe almost entirely by means of our abdominal muscles and diaphragm. The muscles of the thorax are scarcely used. If the lower abdomen is allowed to fill out, the diaphragm is lowered, the thoracic cavity is enlarged, and air is taken into the lungs. When the abdominal muscles contract, the contents of the abdomen are pushed up, which in turn forces the diaphragm up, reducing the amount of thoracic cavity and expelling the air from the lungs. The slow, sustained exhalation that we adopt in Zazen is produced by keeping the diaphragm contracted so that it opposes the action of the abdominal muscles, which are trying to push the air out of the lungs. This opposition generates a state of tension in the abdominal muscles, and the maintenance of this state of tension is of the utmost importance in the practice of Zazen. All other parts of the body are motionless, and their muscles are either relaxed or in a state of constant, moderate tension. Only the abdominal muscles are active. In ways that we should explain later, this activity is a vital part of the mechanism by which concentration and wakefulness of the brain are maintained. Traditionally, in the East, the lower part of the abdomen, called the tandon, has been regarded as the seat of human spiritual power. Correct Zazen posture ensures that the weight of the body is concentrated here, producing a strong tension, and the method of breathing that is adopted reinforces that tension. Now, I want to say, people have read this book and tried his thing, and sometimes many people have not felt this to be very helpful in the early stages. So we don't, in the Rochester Zen Center, teach an extreme stress of the tandon. We say, if this gives you trouble, you might try it, but if it gives you trouble, then breathe normally. Go back to breathing normally. And gradually, the whole process of sitting meditation will naturally lead you to this kind of breathing. So you don't have to force it and take up some thing that seems foreign to you. Just breathe naturally for a while, and then maybe try pushing out with the lower, with the tandon, the lower abdomen, some exhalations, relax it, inhalations. Give it a try. But the one very important thing is to not to take in too much air. You'll have big trouble with this kind of breathing if you allow yourself to take in too much air. And if you do feel, then let part of that air out. And then you're breathing from a level which is almost below the natural level of breathing. That is, you're using the part of the lung that normally doesn't get filled. Well, it doesn't get empty, I should say. Roshi Kaplow used to teach this type of breathing without any words at all. He would just demonstrate. And that gave us all a clue, and we started to be able to do that from his demonstration. This breathing also would be used with the mu koan, or what is it, or who am I. I don't think it necessarily would be used with subsequent koans. So I'll go on here. The essential point we want to make at present is that the correct manipulation of the lower abdomen as we sit and breathe, it is the correct manipulation of the lower abdomen as we sit and breathe that enables us to control the activity of our mind. Posture and breathing are the key to concentration, to stilling the activity of the mind and entering samadhi. Stated so briefly, our conclusion may seem far-fetched. The reader will find our reasons for this conclusion set out in more detail later. But if they don't seem convincing on the page, the reader should experience for himself along the lines we shall indicate. Zen is, above all, a matter of personal experience. The student is asked to accept nothing, the truth of which he cannot demonstrate for himself with his own mind and body. We've already referred to the state of off-sensation in which we lose the sense of the whereabouts of our body. Subsequently, by stilling the activity of our mind, a state is reached in which time, space, and causation which constitute the framework of consciousness, drop away. We call this condition body and mind fallen off. In ordinary mental activity, the cerebral cortex takes the major role, but in this state, apparently, it is hardly active at all. Body and mind fallen off may seem to be nothing but a condition of mere being, but this mere being is accompanied by a remarkable mental power, which we may characterize as a condition of extreme wakefulness. To those who have not experienced it, this description may seem strange, yet the condition really does occur in samadhi. At the time, however, we are not aware of it, because there is no reflecting activity of consciousness, and thus it's hard to describe. I want to read that again. At the time, however, we are not aware of it, because there is no reflecting activity of consciousness. This is really important. If you think the thought, oh, I'm in samadhi, it's definitely not the case. It is the case that you do not know. Your teacher will know when you're in samadhi, but you will not know it yourself. Anyway, he says this is obviously a hard thing to describe. However, if we were to try to describe it, it would be as an extraordinary mental stillness. In this stillness or emptiness, the source of all kinds of activity is latent. It is this state that we call pure existence. This, perhaps, is the most simplified form of human existence. If you catch hold of this state of pure existence and then come back into the actual world of conscious activity, you will find that being itself appears transformed. Because of the possibility of this transformation, being is said to be, quote, veiled in darkness, unquote, to the eyes of those who have not experienced pure existence. When mature in the practice of Zazen, being is seen with one's own eyes. Or, as it's said in the sutras, the Tathagata sees Buddha nature with his naked eyes. Unquote. However, just as energy can be used for many different purposes, so can pure existence be experienced in relation to any phase of life, anger, hatred, or jealousy, as well as love and beauty. Now, every human action must be carried on through the ego, which plays a role analogous to that of a pipe or channel through which energy is conducted for different uses. It may be asked what this ego is. We usually think of the ego as a kind of constant, unchanging entity. In fact, however, it is simply a succession of physical and mental events or pressures which appear momentarily and quickly pass away. However, as so long as our mind operates subjectively, there must be a subject that functions as the ego. As there is normally no cessation of subjective activity, there can normally be no state in which we are devoid of an ego. However, the nature of this ego can change. Every time we succeed in banishing a mean or restricted ego, a petty ego, another ego with broader outlook appears in its place. And eventually what we may call an egoless ego will make its appearance. And when you have acquired an egoless ego, there is no hatred, no jealousy, no fear. You experience a state in which you see everything in its true aspect. It is a state in which you cling to or adhere to nothing. It is not that you are without desires, but that while desiring and adhering to things, you are at the same time unattached to them. The Diamond Sutra says, abiding nowhere, let the mind work. This means do not let your mind be bound by your desire. True freedom is freedom from your own desires. I'm skipping a little here. Zen training continues endlessly. The mean or petty ego, which was thought to have been disposed of, is found once again to be secretly creeping back into one's mind. The long chronic habit of consciousness has implanted evil impulses so firmly in man's mind that they haunt us perpetually, and it's impossible for us to inhibit them before they appear. However, the longer we train ourselves, the more we are liberated from the petty ego. When the petty ego appears, do not be concerned with it. Simply ignore it. When an evil thought strikes you, acknowledge it honestly, saying, "Such and such an evil thought has occurred to me," and then drop it. The Zen saying goes, "The occurrence of an evil thought is a malady. Not to continue it is the remedy." I'm going to close today's Dharma talk with a reading from A New Earth, a book by Eckhart Tolle. This section is called Conscious Suffering. If you have young children, give them help, guidance, and protection to the best of your ability. But even more important, give them space, space to be. They come into this world through you, but they are not yours. The belief, "I know what's best for you," may be true when they are very young, but the older they get, the less true it becomes. The more expectations you have of how their life should unfold, the more you are in your mind instead of being present for them. Eventually, they will make mistakes, and they will experience some form of suffering, as all humans do. In fact, they may be mistakes only from your perspective. What to you is a mistake may be exactly what your children need to do or experience. Give them as much help and guidance as you can, but realize that you may also at times have to allow them to make mistakes, especially as they begin to reach adulthood. At times you may also have to allow them to suffer. Suffering may come to them out of the blue, or it may come as a consequence of their own mistakes. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could spare them all suffering? No, it wouldn't. They would not evolve as human beings and would remain shallow, identified with the external form of things. Suffering drives you deeper. The paradox is that suffering is caused by identification with form and erodes identification with form. A lot of it is caused by the ego, although eventually suffering destroys the ego. But not until you suffer consciously. Humanity is destined to go beyond suffering, but not in the way the ego thinks. One of the ego's many erroneous assumptions, one of its many deluded thoughts is, "I should not have to suffer." Sometimes the thought gets transferred to someone close to you, "My child should not have to suffer." That thought itself lies at the root of suffering. Suffering has a noble purpose, the evolution of consciousness and the burning up of the ego. The man on the cross is an archetypal image. He is every man and every woman. As long as you resist suffering, it is a slow process because the resistance creates more ego to burn up. When you accept suffering, however, there is an acceleration of that process, which is brought about by the fact that you suffer consciously. You can accept suffering for yourself, or you can accept it for someone else, such as your child or parent. In the midst of conscious suffering, there is already the transmutation. The fire of suffering becomes the light of consciousness. The ego says, "I shouldn't have to suffer," and that thought makes you suffer so much more. It is a distortion of the truth, which is always paradoxical. The truth is that you need to say yes to suffering before you can transcend it. And tomorrow we'll be reading exclusively from this book.